From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy. This program's made possible in part through the generous support of State of Belief listeners, and we are very thankful for every one of you. For more information on how you can help keep this show on the air, please visit stateofbelief.com. On our interfaith calendar, April 12th is the Orthodox Christian Easter celebration of Pascha. Tuesday brings Basaki, the sick New Year. And starting at sundown on Wednesday, it's the Jewish observance of Yom HaShoah, Holocaust and Heroism Remembrance Day. Now, here's what's coming up on this week's show.
Prom is later this month, but one student says she won't be attending. The student is gay and says the school is using the prom's dress code to discriminate against her sexual preference.
Claudetia Love is a top senior at a Louisiana high school. A model student, that is, until she asked to wear a tuxedo to her senior prom. Whether the school's refusal to allow it was bias or insensitivity, what happened after the initial refusal is encouraging. And we'll get the story from Asaf Orr, staff attorney at the National Center for Lesbian Rights.
This bill is not about discrimination.
Yeah, but why are so many people opposed to the law here in Indiana when so many other states have similar laws in place?
Religious rights and individual rights can coexist in harmony together.
State-level Religious Freedom Restoration Acts in Indiana and elsewhere have dominated recent headlines. The way these laws are covered goes a long way toward the kind of response they receive. I'll talk about the challenges of doing that responsibly with Religion News Service Editor-in-Chief Kevin Ekstrom. Also, a new campaign responding to the ugly undercurrent of discrimination that is an unfortunate source of support for much of these laws. It's called Everyone Only, and it comes to us courtesy of Interfaith Alliance. Executive Director Jack Moline will have the details for us. But first,
it's weird. We live in a world where we're supposed to be more connected than ever. Our phones, our profiles, our apps, all that stuff is supposed to help you meet cool new people, especially ones who are different from you. But it's not working out that way. Instead, we're more disconnected from each other than ever before. We avoid difference and put ourselves in these bubbles with people who think and act just like we do, especially when it comes to religion.
You might have seen advanced publicity for the Interfaith Youth Core Better Together Day campaign on social media. The date for this initiative is Tuesday, April 14th. And for a look at the objectives of Better Together Day, I'm pleased to be joined by Adam Garner, who is an organizer for the project. Adam, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Hello, and thank you so much for having me.
Describe this experience, what it's all about.
So on April 14th, what we're asking people to do is have a conversation with someone of a different religious or philosophical background about what inspires them. And so we're asking atheists to go talk to Muslims and Christians to go talk to Jews about kind of what about their religious or philosophical background inspires them, what really like gets their blood pumping and what really inspires them to live the best life that they can.
Uh-huh. So this is a major part of what Interfaith Youth Corps does all the time. What's the distinctive here?
This is actually Better Together Day's third year happening. For the last 2 years, we focused on really raising awareness about interfaith cooperation. As a member of the interfaith movement, I'm sure you're aware that the interfaith movement more broadly is just painfully, we're not a big conversation piece at the national level. And so we're like, we just want to raise awareness about what this is about. But this year, we thought about what is the essence of interfaith work? Like, what's the linchpin that makes people really understand the importance of this sort of work? And we thought, it's about conversations. It's about when you make that connection with someone. And so we really just like boiled down all of our methodology, all of our programs to the simplest level of, like, have a conversation with someone. Mm-hmm. We're really excited about the possibilities.
You have done this before, so you have some feedback on it, and you have some ideas of what exactly you'd like to see happen. Beyond the generality, describe what would be a really good conversation or action for one of our listeners to take on this Better Together Day.
Awesome. So actually, one of the cool things about working with college students, which I have the pleasure to do year-round, is they do some amazing and innovative things, and they really push the limits of what the interfaith movement has historically done. So a lot of the ideas that we've incorporated into Better Together Day this year have really come from what we've seen our college students and our student leaders do last year. So if you look at ifyc.org/Better Together Day, like the core ask is there about having a conversation with a different person. But if you scroll a little bit farther down, there are suggestions of how you can actually do this. So this is everything from like going to a different religious or philosophical house of worship and getting a tour of the place, hosting a pop-up conversation at your place of worship or on your campus, where people can quickly drop in and drop out of conversations by using things like, one of my favorite things is we had a student last year drag a full sofa onto their campus quad and plop it down there and put a bowl of questions in front of them. And that's how they invited people into the conversation. So there's a whole flurry of different ideas for how you can actually do this on that website at ifyc.org/Better Together Day. But in terms of like what we really want the conversations to center around, we want them to center around shared values. So those things like compassion, empathy, mercy, those things that are really at the core of our different religious and philosophical backgrounds that really drive us to make the world better. And if I think about the conversations that I had last year when I was actually on campus for Better Together Day at Rhodes College in Memphis, Tennessee, the best conversations I had centered around those sorts of things. And so I would encourage your listeners and for anyone who's interested in getting involved to strike up a conversation with someone and ask questions about, like, what inspires you to make the world a better place? Like, what's a favorite quote from your religious or philosophical background? So those sorts of things.
I see. That's well explained. What kind of participation level are you expecting?
So our first year doing Better Together Day, we had about 1,000 people participate. Last year, we had about 4,000. This year, I think we're hoping to at least hit 5,000. But I'm very optimistic for us blowing past those levels. Mm-hmm. And this is something I think as we continue to do into the future is only going to scale up.
Yeah.
I know of at least 80 campuses off the top of my head from the tracking that I've done that are planning concrete events on campuses across the country. And I'm sure those are just the ones that I'm aware of.
Mm-hmm. Talk with us about some of the longer-term implications of this one-day conversation.
So I think there are probably two things that I can say about that. The first one is we know that a simple conversation with someone, like the moment you build a relationship with someone of a different religious or philosophical background, studies show that that can systematically change the way you see that entire tradition. So, mm-hmm. for example, if I, as an atheist, have a conversation with a Muslim, and it's a really productive one, it's good, I find like areas of resonance between our different backgrounds, that changes the way I see the Muslim tradition as a whole. It's no longer just like these abstract ideas of like Quran, Mecca, Jihad. All of those things now have a face to it, which changes the way that I view Islam more broadly. Mm-hmm. But the second thing I'd say is actually Better Together Day is just part of a year-round campus strategy that IFYC has in what's called the Better Together campaign, which is a network of student groups, student-led interfaith councils, and student-led initiatives on college campuses across the country. And this is kind of like our students' rallying day. It's our day to really like raise our voices and scream from the rooftops about how this work is incredibly important. And so a lot of our students really see this as a day to really build buzz on their campus, mm-hmm. and to really get the word out to their broader community even about the importance of interfaith work and the things that happen year-round.
Yeah. Better Together Day is an initiative from the Interfaith Youth Corps. It's coming up on Tuesday, April 14th. Adam Garner is an organizer for Better Together at the Interfaith Youth Corps. And Adam, I really thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you very much, and it was a pleasure to be with you.
The impressive public outcry over Indiana's and Arkansas's Religious Freedom Acts led to changes in the legislation, but there are numerous other such bills working their way through state houses across the country. Complicating the matter is the umbrella name for these laws, concealing the varying levels of discrimination allowed in their language. It's a tough story to follow, which is why I wanted to ask Religion News Service Editor-in-Chief Kevin Ekstrom about how he's keeping all of this straight. Kevin, Welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
It's good to be back.
It was interesting to see how broadly the case of Indiana's RFRA got covered in mainstream media. First of all, were you surprised at the amount of coverage, and to what do you attribute all that coverage?
It was surprising to the extent that, you know, most state laws don't get any coverage or give very little notice. You know, I think what has changed here are two things. Gay rights advocates are much more vocal than they have been in the past, and they have a bit of wind on their backs, you know, with all the recent victories on gay marriage, you know, in what, 37 states now, I think, and probably at the Supreme Court this summer. There's a lot of momentum there, and so there's a new energy in the LGBT crowd that not only can they come out and criticize a piece of legislation like this, but they actually have a very real chance of defeating it, and that's kind of what we saw there. I think the other thing that changed is that the LGBT advocates have a lot more allies than they used to. So they had corporate America. They had NASCAR. Whoever thought that NASCAR would be talking about gay rights? Or the NCAA basketball. And in Arkansas, you had Walmart, of all companies, come out against the state RFRA there. So there's a much greater offense, I think, being put on these sorts of initiatives. And the traditional voices that we've always heard in these debates from the conservative evangelicals and also the family research councils of the world, they're actually playing defense now, and that's a new posture.
And you know, Kevin, for people like you and me who are very interested in what's going on in these proposed pieces of legislation, the public is beginning to understand that this isn't just about a single issue, that what's at stake in these state laws covers a broad variety of issues that somewhere in there everybody has a stake in.
Right. And so, you know, the presenting issue here is anti-gay discrimination, and you know, specifically whether or not a cake baker can turn away a gay couple for their wedding. That's sort of what everybody's talking about. But underneath all of that, there are all sorts of scenarios that aren't just doomsday scenarios, but they're actually, you know, pretty viable scenarios where you could turn away an interracial couple from your motel because you don't believe in interracial marriage because you think your faith tells you not to. You could say, I'm not going to hire, you know, a minority because my faith tells me this, that, or the other thing. So there are real plausible scenarios here that don't just affect gay people, and I think that's what got people really worried and concerned about this sort of thing. And the fact that it was being so sort of easily dismissed. Oh, well, we're not talking about discrimination. Nobody is going to actually discriminate using this, until you had a pizza shop owner in Indiana come out and say, well, actually, yes, I would turn away a gay customer if they wanted me to cater to their wedding. So people don't like discrimination generally, and they definitely don't like it when it has the imprimatur of the state or of the government. And that's, I think, what really got people concerned about this one.
Kevin, it seems to me like that once a story gets that big, then some of the important details in the story tend to get lost. Did you see that happening?
Yeah, actually, Indiana was a very good example. So the advocates of the religious freedom law said, well, you know, this law is no different from what's already out there in 20-some states, and the federal government has the same law. So really, there's nothing to see here, there's no story, because we're just doing what other states have already done. What they didn't mention, though, was that the Indiana law was very specific and very different from those other laws, and that it was, in fact, more restrictive, allowed more avenues for discrimination. And the big thing is that it opened the door for these discrimination suits between two parties, whereas the federal law and most of the other laws had to involve the government. So it was a much lower standard for how this law could be used, and frankly made the door wider open towards possible discrimination. And that's what the advocates weren't talking about. And a lot of the mainstream media, you know, sort of went with that and said, oh, there's nothing to see here. Until about 2 or 3 days in, and people started to say, wait a minute, let's look at this actual law, and you started to see a lot of coverage of how this law, in fact, was very different than everything else. And I think that's, you know, what really started to change people's minds on it.
Kevin, as editor-in-chief at Religion News Service, your responsibility is to manage coverage of major stories. What kind of decisions did you have to make in covering this wide-ranging story?
So, yeah, a story like this that breaks fast and is changing every day, at some point, you have to sort of decide, are we going to cover every turn of the screw every time something happens, or are we going to try to step back and do a larger story? And really what we decided to do on this one was to offer a platform to the various voices in the debate, both on the left and on the right. Mm-hmm. And some of our coverage that actually got the most traction was from the conservative point of view about why this law they thought was needed, but also how Christians specifically can engage in the culture war, this time over gay marriage, but do it in a way that is respectful of people's differences and does not alienate and is not trying to draw lines around this, that, or the other thing. So, you know, a big story like this, it's hard to cover, and you're competing with a lot of people. So oftentimes the best way to do it is to not tell people what happened, but try to explain to them why it matters.
So one of the arguments that supporters of Indiana's law in its original form were making was that it had the same language as the federal RFRA signed by Bill Clinton, as you said. How was it possible to parse that claim?
Well, if you look at the plain letter of the law, it was significantly different. The timing of this is what I think concerned a lot of people. So if you go back to 1993 with the original federal religious freedom law, that was in reaction to a case that went to the Supreme Court that essentially involved Native Americans smoking peyote. And most people, by and large, don't have a problem with that. The most recent kind of incarnation that we've seen of this was earlier this year, where it dealt with the question of, could a Muslim inmate grow a beard in prison? People look at that, they say, well, that's fairly straightforward. I can understand that. That's fine. But the reason why you're seeing this proliferation of laws is it's not coincidental that it's tied to gay marriage and the spread of gay marriage. So Indiana, you know, now has gay marriage. And wouldn't you know it, a couple months later, this law comes up. And so in a lot of ways, it doesn't pass the sniff test that, oh, this is just like any other law, or this, you know, we're just copying what the federal government has done. Because when a state like this passes a law, people start to ask, well, why? What's the need for it? If we haven't had it before, why do we need it now? And you immediately start to connect the dots to the gay marriage, and then people start talking about discrimination. And that's, I think, where a lot of people draw the line.
There are a number of states with some version of a religious freedom law in the legislative process. How in the world are you tracking those, and what's important to know about each one?
The thing to watch for is whether or not the state in question has an anti-discrimination law that protects gay people. So here's an example. In New Mexico, which also has a religious freedom law on the books, there is another law that says you cannot discriminate against people based on race, class, ethnicity, gender, but also sexual orientation. And so when a photographer there refused to photograph a lesbian wedding, she was essentially charged with violating the anti-gay discrimination law. In Indiana, there is no such protection for gay discrimination. There's no federal protection. So if a religious freedom law goes up in a state that has gay protections, then in large measure, it's already settled. But in a state like Indiana, which doesn't have it, it leaves a lot more latitude towards possible discrimination. So the thing that people should be looking for is whether that state has said or is willing to say that anti-gay discrimination is illegal.
Kevin, I don't know whether I'm being objective or cynical here in asking this question, and I haven't seen anybody write about it yet, but the motivation behind these laws, like in Indiana and what was proposed first go around in Arkansas, the legislators were almost absolutist in defending morality and trying to pass these laws because of basic convictions that religious people and others have. And then both states back up when the NCAA or NASCAR or Walmart say this is a bad idea. What happened to the moral conviction when they changed these? Or is that just a cynical question that doesn't need to be answered?
Well, I think maybe it's a little bit of both. So what we're seeing here is there's a profound shift happening in real time around us on the question of gay marriage. And I think it's fairly safe to say that the opponents of gay marriage have lost, and they know they have lost, and they know that they are quickly losing the battle of public opinion on this. So what they're trying to do is, in many ways, fairly reasonable. They're trying to carve out some safe space for themselves and their beliefs. Mm-hmm. So, okay, fine. If you insist that we're going to have gay marriage, don't make us be a part of it. You know, don't make us violate our beliefs. And that's the backdrop to a lot of what's going on here. And that's why you're seeing these laws. The thing, though, is that for better or worse, that conviction, at least in terms of the public square, has not gained a whole lot of traction. Mm-hmm. You know, nobody that I know of or have spoken to or read about is going to tell a Catholic priest, you have to marry a gay couple. Nobody is going to tell a Muslim imam, you have to marry a lesbian couple. That protection is very clear-cut and is backed up by 200 years' worth of history. What's less clear and what we're all arguing about now is when that discrimination doesn't happen in a house of worship but happens on the town square, then what happens? And by and large, most Americans tend to think that if you are going to engage in the public square, then you have to engage with all comers, whether they're gay, lesbian, black, Asian, doesn't matter. That if you hang out your shingle, you have to be willing to work with everybody. And if you're not, then you have to be prepared to accept the consequences. I don't know that we're seeing so much a loss of conviction, but what you're seeing is a very real-time debate about what this means, what it looks like, what the parameters are, what they should be or what they shouldn't be. And it's this very sort of organic animal that everybody is trying to figure out what this actually means. And I think we're starting to get glimpses of kind of an emerging semi-consensus, if we can call it that.
I know you're planning coverage of the anticipated Supreme Court ruling on marriage equality, and there's a definite connection between some of these state laws and the expected outcome. What are you keeping an eye on as you think about that decision?
That decision is going to be monumental whichever way it goes. Let's assume for a minute that the court rules in favor of gay marriage, which I think is a very, very, very likely scenario. How much space do they create for opponents? That's the question to ask. How much room do they leave for people who disagree with this, either on philosophical or moral or religious grounds? And I suspect that the court, you know, is not wanting to go lock people up who disagree with this. So they will try to create some space. But to what extent do they look to give government sanction to a way of life that a lot of people still find objectionable? That's really what we're talking about. It's government approval or government endorsement of gay and lesbian married couples. And I would be looking for how far they go with that. And I suspect they're going to try to stick fairly close to the middle.
Kevin Ekstrom is editor-in-chief of the award-winning Religion News Service. Kevin, this is a tough one. I'm glad you were able to join us and offer some really helpful insights into how this story is reaching us. So thanks again for being on State of Belief Radio.
Well, I'm glad that even though you're retired, you're still doing the show. So I'm happy to be back.
Earlier this month, a top high school student right here in Monroe, Louisiana, from which we're taping this show, announced that she wanted to wear a tuxedo to her senior prom. Claudetia Love's school said she couldn't do that, leading to some of her friends threatening to boycott the prom. Enter the National Center for Lesbian Rights and a reconsideration of the issue by the school district. Joining me right now is Asif Orr, staff attorney at the center. Asif, welcome to State of Belief Radio.
Thank you very much for having me.
I think a lot of people might think of this as no big deal, just a youth thing. Why was this so important for Claudetia?
Well, you know, for her, wearing a tux to her prom is a core part of her identity. As a lesbian and as a person, that's how she identifies. And so what the school essentially was doing by saying that she had to wear a dress was censoring a core part of her identity. And that's why it was so important.
Tell us why NCLR got involved in this case.
Well, we got involved because we saw that this is an issue. Clearly, the school made an error in terms of their judgment in setting forth this policy or making this decision. Mm-hmm. And we wanted to work with the family to make it right so she could attend her prom and have a good experience with her friends like all other seniors want.
Have you done a similar intervention as well elsewhere in the nation?
Not recently. Thankfully, these issues are starting to decline, although, unfortunately, they're still around. And typically, you know, with these cases, what happens is we get involved or another organization like the National Center for Lesbian Rights gets involved and is able to amicably resolve these cases before even they hit the media. So thankfully, hopefully they'll be on the decline from now, particularly given all the media attention to this case.
Tell us how this unfolded. What was the school's initial reaction to what she wanted to do?
Well, it really unfolded quite quickly. You know, Claudetia had her mother speak with the school after they initially told her that she was not going to be able to wear a tux. And once this hit the media, to their credit, the two school board members very swiftly said, you know, we really need to stand behind Claudetia and her right to wear a tux to the prom. And so, you know, they sort of had internally their discussions, which I don't know exactly what they were, mm-hmm. But ultimately the matter resolved very quickly with the president of the board, Reverend mm-hmm. McFarland, and Principal Taylor calling our client this past Monday morning mm-hmm. to inform her that she would be able to wear a tux.
So actually the initial reaction that was negative was just within a very limited number of people.
That's correct. And, you know, what Principal Taylor had told Geraldine, Claudetia's mom, was that, you know, boys wear tuxes and girls wear dresses and that's the way it is. And, mm-hmm. You know, if you're allowed to wear a tux, I'm concerned that teachers would not be willing to chaperone the prom. Claudetia's sister had overheard people referencing her request and saying it's a sin. Mm-hmm. I think that's what it sort of factored into their initial position. As I indicated, the president of the board was very clear and said, it's her right to wear a tux to the prom, and we're going to make sure it happens.
Were you surprised at the lack of resistance once you began to inquire about it?
No, because I think, thankfully, even when we get involved, there is sort of a, oh, we didn't know kind of response, and not really realizing, because I think for a lot of schools, this is maybe the first time they've had to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
And once we sort of have an opportunity to talk to them and explain to them what the law requires, it's typically very quick that the school will reverse course. It's not always the case, but most often the case.
Asif, talk for a minute about what parents and educators should keep in mind if a similar situation ever surfaces in someone else's backyard.
I think what's critical is just to support the student. That is what is going to, from both the family's perspective as well as educators, that's what's going to make sure that their students or children can grow up to be happy and healthy adults and grow and develop in the ways that we want them to. And that's really consistent with the goal of education, not only to support their academic growth, but to also support their social and emotional growth.
You know, I live in this community. I know the people whom you've referenced in your conversations. And I have to tell you, I mean, this is a community that is almost at the buckle of the Bible Belt and has shown some sad discrimination at points related to GLBT issues. And I don't know whether it was your encouragement, your conversations, or what, but I have to tell you that I was stunned at the way the leadership in the community stepped up and acted so responsibly. The head of the school board that you mentioned, the bishop, did as beautiful a job as I've ever heard in explaining in the media that whether or not he as a minister agreed or disagreed with the woman's sexual orientation, there was absolutely no question in his mind about what the right thing to do was, and it was to give this young lady her rights and assure that she was able to go to the prom. It's a story with a happy ending, and that's not always the case. I imagine there are a lot of young people in places like Monroe that would never dream of standing up in the way that Claudetia Love did. She's been quoted as saying she didn't want other students to feel marginalized. So, Asif, you all did a terrific job here and brought out something good in this community that not all of us would have anticipated.
Yeah, and I think, as you mentioned, a lot of credit has to go to Reverend McFarland as well as Claudetia for both really standing up for what is right. I mean, Reverend McFarland said, you know, I'm not the pastor of the school board, and really focused on, look, we need to be focusing on our students' academics and really not discriminating against any student. I think that is an amazing and commendable position to be taking. And for Claudetia to really sort of take the stance publicly and say, look, I don't want this to happen to anyone else. It was hurtful that the school was going to deny my identity, but, you know, really stood up for it. And I think we'll hopefully create an environment where other kids in the future, both in Monroe and in the surrounding areas, will say, you know what, it's going to be okay. I can tell people who I really am, and I'm going to get support.
Asif Orr, staff attorney at the National Center for Lesbian Rights, thank you so much for taking us inside this story here on State of Belief.
Thank you so much for having me.
Even as religious freedom laws in Indiana, Arkansas, North Carolina, and elsewhere make headlines with varying degrees of right to discriminate language, there are many of us that may be feeling the need to counter the undercurrent of bias that they reveal. Hashtag Everyone Only is a new campaign from Interfaith Alliance that offers a way tangibly to say no to discrimination. And I am pleased, as always, that this brings Alliance Executive Director Jack Moline back to State of Belief Radio. Jack, thanks for being with us again.
It is always a pleasure to be here, Welton.
Talk about Everyone Only. Tell us about that campaign.
We were sitting in the office watching Governor Pence squirm over this mini RFRA in Indiana. And Jay Keller, who many of your listeners know from conversations in the office and his good work with our field operation, said, you know, we ought to have a sign that people put up that distances them from these prejudicial laws that are being enacted. We kicked it around a little bit and came up with this notion of we serve everyone only, which is what the sign says. And it is available online for anybody who wants it. at www.everyone-only.org. I'm sure I will repeat that at least twice more in this conversation. And as we began to develop what the sign would look like, we realized that the reason it resonated so well with us is because of the kinds of signs that popped up in various places in the United States at various times in its history. Down in your neighborhood, Welton, down in the South, it was whites only and coloreds only that that often appeared over drinking fountains and bathrooms and theater seats and the like. Where I grew up in the Midwest, I was more used to seeing signs that said no Jews, no Irish, things like that. And we thought we might be able to resonate with both the message of the united faith and philosophy communities that we're not going to stand by that anymore, and remind people of what the danger of these exclusionary rules are by creating a sign that said, we serve everyone only.
Yeah. Well, you know, the way you have explained that, not only is a good explanation of the campaign, but it does call attention to the fact that what we're talking about here is the right to discriminate across the board, and to do that in the name of religion, and to even allow for racial discrimination and other, as well as other kinds. Now, I understand the divisive nature of these right to discriminate laws and the ugly conversations that have gone on over the Religious Freedom Restoration Act bills. But how do these signs impact that conversation?
Well, I'm hoping that, first of all, it will make people conscious of the fact that our public society ought to be open to everyone equally in the United States, and that any attempt to restrict where people can go, what kind of commerce they can engage in, where they can expect the kinds of services that have been made generally available to the public, seeing these signs will make them aware that this is a public issue and not a matter simply of private conscience. And I'm hoping that with the proliferation of these signs, people will still, if they choose, hold to their beliefs that are informed by their faith traditions as they understand them. But they will understand that there is an ethic in our country that, while it protects personal religious belief and practice, does not allow that practice to be translated into public policy.
Jack, the day that this campaign began, your friend, my wife, Judy, wrote for one of the campaign posters. Now, that's good, but I know you want businesses to be involved. How do we get businesses involved?
You know, it's really very simple. If everybody who's listening to this program went to our site, and here comes the second mention, www.everyone-only.org, and downloaded the sign, printed it out, ideally on cardstock, it'll last a little longer, but even on just a plain piece of printer paper, and it's mostly black and white, so it won't eat up your printer ink, and walked it down to a local business and asked them to put it up, we would have thousands and thousands of these signs all over the country. It's particularly important in those states that are considering these mini-RFRAs. But look, I live in the Commonwealth of Virginia, where our governor, Terry McAuliffe, has rejected the notion that these laws would be enacted, and our Attorney General, Mark Herring, has actively worked to reverse whatever such laws are in effect in Virginia. I walked into my local card and gift shop, which is independently owned, asked the owner if he would put it up, and he asked me for two so that he could put it in his glass door so that on a warm day when the door is open, people would see it on the inside of the door, and on a cold day when the door is closed, they would see it on the outside of the door. It's really very, very simple. I think people will have more success going to independently owned businesses than they will to those that are chains, because there's generally a management decision that's necessary at a level higher than the local.
You also, I think this is important, you also want pictures of the signs once they're posted so that it can be shared on social media.
Absolutely. That's what we are hoping people will do. Once those signs are up, just take a snapshot of them. They can post them right back to that website. Here's the mention again, www.everyone-only.org. Send them to us, post them on the website, and we will show people that all over the country there are independent business owners, and we hope because of our efforts, some of the larger chains that will display these and make it clear that that everyone, regardless of their faith, their practice, or their lack thereof of either one, is welcome to shop.
Okay, one more time, both with the information that you've been giving and also a very succinct explanation of how people listening to this show can get involved.
Step one, go to www.everyone-only.org. Step two, click on Print the Sign. Step three, take that printed sign to your local business and ask them to post it. Step four, take a picture and send it to us. And those of you who'd like to post your picture to social media using the hashtag EveryoneOnly will get it greater circulation.
EveryoneOnly. It is a terrific campaign. Rabbi Jack Moline is Executive Director of Interfaith Alliance. Interfaith Alliance is spearheading this new EveryoneOnly campaign to encourage an overt expression of inclusivity at businesses nationwide. There's more information and a printable sign available at www.everyone-only.org. Jack and I surely have given you enough information. Jack, thank you for the briefing, and thank you and the Interfaith Alliance for doing this campaign. Everyone Only. Thanks, man.
Thank you, Welton. Talk to you soon.
Before we go, it's been way too long since we stood out here at the crossroads of religion, government, and politics to hand out some intersection awards. Frankly, we just couldn't get enough insurance coverage. It was just too risky to be in that intersection. But we've worked that out now, and so here we are once again, ready to assign a green go light, a yellow caution light, or a red stop light to some recent headline-making events and the people behind them. Producer Ray Kirstein has the stories for us. Ray?
Thanks, Welton. In light of ongoing debates over state laws defending the right to discriminate in the name of religious freedom, the Reverend Drew Ludwig of Lafayette Avenue Presbyterian Church in Buffalo, New York, handed over 500 cupcakes baked by members of his congregation out at area gay bars last weekend. Saying he wasn't out to recruit anyone to his church, the pastor told a reporter, quote, "Christianity is about providing service, not denying it. Jesus was about loving people, serving people, not denying service. No matter what, we can love you and serve you."
Go, man. That's a green all the way. He gets it about what religion is about, and he also gets it about what religious freedom is about.
Here's another one with a food connection. Our friends at the Family Research Council issued a nationwide call for 21 days of prayer and fasting to atone for allowing LGBT rights to make progress in this country. No, really, this is supposed to help force the Supreme Court justices into making what FRC would consider the right decision on marriage equality. Now, I'll need to do some fasting myself to fit into my tux before it's time to head to the altar, but that's another story. Meanwhile, is it cool to be praying for the denial of civil rights to others?
I think that even the idea of that is an insult to God. So, red, red, red.
Senator Ted Cruz has followed up his announcement of a run for the White House with a radical plan to strip courts of the right to decide cases involving marriage equality. Now, the chaos that this kind of messing with the separation of powers would bring is hard to measure, but attempts at this kind of defiance have a history among the likes of Alabama Chief Justice Roy Moore. Do we really need a member of the legislative branch who aspires to the executive branch bullying the judicial branch over who gets to marry whom?
You know, regardless of what party this guy represents, Ted Cruz represents something that is offensive to the balance of power in our Constitution and offensive to using the government or his religion as a source of discrimination. You just have used up all of my red lights.
All right, then this past week, President Barack Obama joined a growing number of mental health professionals and activists at the state level in coming out in strict opposition to so-called reparative therapy for young LGBT people.
That is a bright green, and I think it is being done from his perspective as the leader of our government, not because of his personal religious views. That's the way those kinds of decisions ought to be made for someone in the White House or in Congress or in the courts. And so I would give it a green all the way. Quickly now, two personal words before we go, one sad, one encouraging. Earlier this week, our nation lost one of its preeminent religious and civil rights leaders, Reverend Dr. Gardner Taylor. For me, Dr. Taylor was a mentor, a model, and a friend. Also earlier this week, my heart leaped for joy when leaders in my hometown fought off familiar bigotry influenced by religion and assured a young African-American high school student that neither her choice of clothing nor her sexual orientation would keep her from attending her school's prom. We did the story on it earlier in the program. The head of the school board explained that freedom for every person cannot be denied because of the values of some people's religion. I was proud and encouraged. Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you've made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, thank you, thank you, thank you. The ongoing financial support of our listeners is essential to keeping this show on the air. If you find value in what you're hearing, I urge you to join our other generous supporters today. Please visit stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stateofbelief.com is also where you can sign up for our free weekly podcast and find links mentioned during the show. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter. And share the stories you find compelling with your friends. We really need you to help spread the word. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. So be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief. The only one who could ever reach me was the son of a preacher man. The only boy who could ever teach me was the son of a preacher man. You see what he was.